This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On today's episode, I speak with author Erin Caffell about her memoir, The Mourner's Bestiary. Erin Caffell was a very young girl when she learned about polycystic kidney disease, or PKD, and the ways it had affected her family for generations. The heritable PKD was part of her consciousness while she observed the ways her father and other family members endured dialysis and the other ravages of it and died young. Most of her family members were dead by the age of 50 because of this disease. Erin Caffell was 22 when she herself was diagnosed. Even so, she makes the decision to have a child. Aligned with this family story is the story of the ways in which marine life struggles to survive in a fast-warming marine ecosystem. In trying to understand her own grief and the acceptance of her destiny as someone who has inherited PKD, Erin Caffell studies the marine life of Long Island Sound and the Gulf of Maine. She examines the ways in which the marine animals continue to exist. This idea connects her to an idea about her own existence and her will to keep living while accepting exactly who she is. I spoke to Erin Caffell about her memoir, The Mourner's Bestiary. I do want to start with the title of your book because it really captures our attention. As I've been walking around carrying the book around, people have asked me, wow, that's such an amazing title. What does it mean? What does the title mean? How does it name this book for you?
Yeah, the title, The Mourner's Bestiary, was something that actually came to me before I really knew how to write the book. And I feel like I was living with the title as an idea for a really long time as I tried to figure out how to braid the various subject matter areas that I was going to try and combine in the book. I'm lucky enough to have an aunt who's a medievalist, and I was kind of obsessed with medieval literature when I was a child, thanks to books that she would drop off for me at Christmas time, and was always really interested in the bestiary as a form of early natural history conversation between people, but also as spiritual metaphor, as a way to create a teaching tool that both was trying to teach science as early as it was, but also was attempting to create a way to understand what animals could mean to people and to explicate what they mean to people. And so for me, as I was thinking of it, I knew I always wanted to have each chapter be a creature. And a creature from an ecosystem that I loved and that I thought about, because they were so much touchstones for me as a child. And as a science writer, I began to really just read very deeply into the scientific literature of the impact of eco-collapse on our more than human kin. And that unpacked for me just really deep resonances between my own story and the stories of animals in these ecosystems. And so I've come from a family that is facing an incurable disease that has gone through waves of loss over multiple generations. And I also really wanted to explore the question of mourning and what that means in the context of both my own personal experience with my family, but also what we're collectively mourning right now as we face and live with the impacts of climate change and plastic pollution and eco-collapse in various ways across the globe.
You do this amazing thing with this gorgeous memoir about your life, but it is, as you said, braided with these other ideas about ecological collapse. So there's so much in this book that links the human experience of illness, in this case, polycystic kidney disease, and then the kinds of things that exist in the natural world that affect the natural world. And so it's just amazing to me. When I read the summary of the book, I thought, wow, what is that alignment about? But yeah, you do something so interesting with this. You have such an affinity for the ocean and sea life, and specifically Long Island Sound and the Gulf of Maine. And you bring out this idea that I found so interesting about your family being what you call drowning people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in this case, the ocean, the water that you love, that, you know, represents life and so on, is also in other cases, something that is almost too much to bear.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, we've gone to the ocean as a family for solace, for recreation, for connection, for, generations. But we also have a disease which is basically a fluid-based illness where we are filling up with fluid, with water that's in the wrong place, with an inability to process water in our own bodies, and a retention within these cysts in the kidneys that eventually swell the kidneys. Mine are currently 6 times their normal size. That's very typical for someone in my phase of the disease. And so I felt very much that, from a really young age, I kind of understood my family to be drowning. When you are young and watch someone go through dialysis, you are very much in conversation with how much water is in their body. When you're living with someone who's going through dialysis, you are acutely aware, as they are, of how much water they're consuming, how much liquid is coming into their body, and how much is going out. And so there was always this sense of what we're doing to protect the people that we love in our family who are struggling with disease is completely in relationship to our being able to protect them from drowning within their own cells. And I thought about that and sat with it for a really long time. And the metaphor just kept reintroducing itself. And I think, when I was a songwriter before I wrote this book, you couldn't pick up any of my songs without kind of noticing that there was a water obsession. They were all about glaciers. They were all about, Arctic exploration. They were all about floods. And my favorite book is Moby Dick. I obviously have an incredible obsession with the ocean, but I started unpacking as I got a little bit older, and as I began to live with the symptoms of the disease, I started realizing, oh, that affinity is so much deeper, and it's so important for me to be able to not shut myself off to what I love about the water, about oceans, just because I have a complicated relationship to the water in my own body. And the more that I thought about that work, the more I thought that's actually the work we're all doing, whether we're physically in drowning bodies or whether we're, in relationship to water being where we don't want it. Sea level rise, even droughts, I feel like so much of living in the era of climate collapse is living in relationship to water and what it means and where it goes and how it's changing weather systems. And it seemed incredibly important to me to continue the work of writers I really deeply admired who were trying to figure out a way where we could change our language and narrative so that we could figure out how to sit with that incredible change. And it seemed to me the same work that what I was doing in my own body to deal with my mortality and my fear of my illness was the same thing that I was having to do with my love of the ocean and my fear for it and what its future was going to be.
These are some weighty, heady topics, and there's a lot of science here. And your book is so deeply researched, just to look at the pages and pages of references. So it's so impressive. But what you're able to do for us is, I wouldn't even say break it down, but just give it to us in a story that is part of your story. I think you were 9 years old when you found out about what you call the Caffel curse. So you were a very, very young person when you learned about this disease in your family, and you were exposed to the concept of dialysis at such a young age with members of your family. And so it's just so interesting to me how something was planted even there about this idea of your constant awareness of water with your loved ones and your constant awareness of water at Dog Shit Beach, or your constant awareness at all of these places that you love, and your mother is someone who loved the ocean. And I just found that so interesting that you were able to pull, let's say, an anecdote from childhood and pin it on something much larger, much more global, and much more sort of beyond yourself and your family. And that's how we come to understand this other thesis of your book around climate change. And so it's not so much that you broke it down or, gave it to us like we're 3 years old or whatever, but that it just comes to us in this amazing story. What was your process like? I know it was a very long process.
Yeah, it was. This was not a quick book to write. I had many of the ideas and many of the concepts of what I wanted to communicate, but the act of trying to find the form of it, so that I could take the reader where my mind was going. I think I am gifted with spiderweb thinking as kind of like my natural default space, right? And I was raised by scientists, so you can't live with a person in training to get their master's in geology without walking around the world seeing maps overlaid over, highway offcuts, right? Like to be able to see the world in terms of geologic processes, which is something that my mom showed me every time we went anywhere traveling or hiking. And also, this sense of the way that water works as a metaphor, the way that story works. I was an avid reader. So all of these things felt like in my life they were happening simultaneously, and I didn't sort of understand it as something that was unusual. And, I've joked that I'd rather talk about fish than anything else. So that's very true. And when I was going through the process of trying to figure out how to tell this story, I found myself really, spending a lot of time researching individual animals that I was obsessed with as a kid, or that I found to be really important in the story, in the larger story of the ecosystem. And when I would go deep into those stories, into the narratives of their lives that were present in scientific papers, because a good scientific paper is like a deeply thought through narrative that helps the reader. In my case, I'm not a trained scientist. I have a bachelor's degree in English, right? I know the difference between my training and my mother's training or my grandmother's training. But if a paper is well written, if a paper is really thoughtful, it's going to tell you a story. And when I was going into those stories so deeply, there were just places where that spider web would just connect to something from my childhood, or it connect to something from my readings in spirituality or in, grief processing. And whenever I was able to find those connections, then the task became, how do I make that something that feels comfortable and easy for the reader, where the reader feels taken in hand so that they don't get overwhelmed with the science? Because I think, as a person who's been working in climate change writing for a really long time, I go to a lot of dinner parties where no one wants to talk about what I'm interested in because it seems like it's going to be frightening, or confusing, or that they don't know enough to be able to enter into the narrative of what's happening on their planet. And I really wanted to construct something so that there was a good balance between presenting the story of an animal or an ecosystem as a story, as a narrative, alongside a narrative of my own family, so that you could feel contained in both as a reader, and not feel that you were being thrown into a place where you had to have special expertise or special affinity for a scientific topic. I have that. Let me take you and show you why it's interesting. Felt like my job as a writer.
Oh, and it worked. I mean, so we're not talking like my octopus teacher, but close, close. But I still had this sense of, oh, I want to know more about this squid or this whale or this.
Oh, that's so good.
Yes. And you say something at the very end of the book. In fact, it's in the thank you section in the acknowledgments where you say, to my father for shaping me and to my mother for saving me. I want to say something about the people in your family. The people in this book, it's your story, but it's really the story of many other people, and they are endlessly fascinating to me. Your dad, your mom, Mac, everybody is, and Lois, everybody is just so interesting to me that for that alone, I would say to people, you've got to read this book. And I did say that several times while I was reading the book. You've got to read this. Can you say something about your parents? And this, I'm sorry, this is so on the spot, but something you'd like to say about your dad or your mom within this particular book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things about losing members of your family when you're young and spending a lifetime trying to sort of unpack their stories means that you are, in a way, you're constantly trying to bring the dead back to life at different parts of your life, right? Where you have new understandings of who they are. My parents were incredibly compelling people just on their own. Both of them were artists. They met in the film business in New York in the 1970s. They had this very fascinating bohemian life. My father came from this really working class Irish Catholic family that also had this disease and also had just had this incredibly interesting set of siblings. And so I didn't think that was unusual growing up. I didn't think that that the kind of bohemia that I was raised in was anything terribly remarkable. It just seemed, of course you're surrounded by curious, interested people who are going to throw over their film career to go make Shaker furniture by hand in their 30s. Of course that happens. Of course you're going to be an actress, and then you're going to decide when your husband gets sick that you've got to go get a degree in geology and you're going to go work for the EPA. Like, who doesn't do that? But as I matured into, the rest of my life, I've begun to understand how singular they were. And, I've really tried over years and years of processing the grief of losing my father, and then, in the last 5 years after losing my mother, to try and figure out how to reconstruct their complexity, because I idolize the things that they gave me, the gifts of their experience, their interest, their focus, their curiosity, their bravery. But also they were living with a lot of really difficult stuff and didn't have a great way to process it. And, the damage in our family that occurred from the kidney disease wasn't really understandable to me from the outside until I began to do some really deep research into the psychological impact of polycystic kidney disease itself on family populations. And there's a great study that was done in Vermont in the 1970s that was tracking families like mine. And when I started to read the narratives that were part of that study, I was like, oh, there we are. There we are. That's what happens when you take these incredibly vibrant, complicated people who are trying to live outside of the normal paths of culture, and you throw this really traumatic experience into their lives. And it made it possible for me to sort of see, as did becoming an adult and a person with their own kid, to be able to see all of the facets of them in a way that I didn't when I first started trying to write about them in my 20s. And hopefully, I'm thinking the best compliment that I've gotten about the way that the family narrative plays out in the book is that, from family members who say, oh, they're alive on the page, I recognize them. It's like they're back. That's a huge gift.
That is a huge gift. And I never knew them, but I feel like I know them. They're just such gorgeous part of this story. I just wanted to
Thank
know
you.
more and more and more about them. And you are a mom, as you said.
Yeah.
Was there ever a time when you thought you wouldn't be a mom?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's one of the things that was really helpful for me to explore through the writing process was the complexity of going through the decision to have a child from the point of my diagnosis when I was in my tw early 20s until having my kid 10 years later. I'm from this family where it's 150 years of people dying before the age of 50. In my father's generation was sort of the first time that they really understood the genetic component, the incredible prevalence of passing on this mutation to children. And my father sort of accidentally decided to have a biological child. None of his siblings decided to have kids because they were so traumatized by what happened to their own father. I really wrestled with whether I felt like I was entitled. It was a weird word to use, but I think that's the way that the culture presents it. Whether I was entitled to be able to have a child of my own biologically. And it's a huge and complicated issue, and I don't really work in the realms of reproductive justice. And I don't really have any opinion myself about what people decide to do in terms of genetic selection of embryos. Now that that's possible to select away from this disease, there are many people who have a family history of this that do that work to try and make sure that they are able to have children who don't have this huge shadow over them. But even that wasn't really available to me when I made the decision. And so for me, it was a decision about, I mean, disability justice loosely, but also what is the value of my life? What was the value of my father's? Are we only reducible down to the sort of eugenic idea of like our purity and like our health as being the most important aspect? And could I picture parenting my own child with enough clarity about my disease that I wasn't going to impact the way that they came to think about the potential of their own? And, I made a decision thinking with a lot of hubris that I could sort of figure it out. And then I had to write this whole book to make sure that I processed it properly. But I do feel like, my kid's about to turn 20, and I feel like we have a very different relationship to my disease than I did to my father's. And they have a very different relationship to their disease than I did to my own when I was on the cusp of entering my 20s. And so This is the part of the book's thesis that I think is really important, which is, survival and generational healing, and even what we could do to impact the lives of vulnerable human beings who have chronic illness or genetic illness, what we can do to impact the lives of non-human entities that are in these incredibly threatened ecosystems. We have this idea that it's just we only have these 5 years to fix it, and in so many ways that's true, but we also have this incredible generational potential for healing, for reducing trauma, for repair, where new things become possible in the decades that you manage to survive and believe yourself to be deserving of life and of complex, interesting experiences like motherhood. Things show up that you didn't expect when you were 20. And I think that that's true for people who work in environmental justice as well. Like, there are ways forward that we don't know yet. And the trick is to stay alive, to keep the creatures that we're protecting alive long enough so that we can get closer to repair.
You are a musician too.
I am.
You mentioned your songwriting. I've watched some of your videos on YouTube.
Oh,
Your music is gorgeous. I mean,
thank you.
your voice is so beautiful just listening to you, but your singing voice is, you're an angel.
Oh, thank you.
So how did music, I kind of knew, or I can
Yeah, it's in
you got to read
the
the
book a
book.
little bit.
What can you say about music for yourself and the writing, just for yourself?
I mean, there were only two things I ever wanted to do when I was a kid, and that was make music and write books. And I think I was very clear on that from a really young age. There are cassette tapes of me making up songs from when I was 5. My mother used to hand scribe all of my stories into spiral bound notebooks before I could write. Like, this was absolutely my sense of identity, even though I was growing up with a craftsman and a scientist as my parents. I just never really wanted to do anything else. And when I was diagnosed, I was very much on a path to go get a PhD and be an English professor. I loved that work. I had always wanted to do creative writing, but I also really loved reading and thinking and critical thought. And my diagnosis kind of pushed me into this place of, well, so, I mean, like, to paraphrase the one wild and precious life, what are you going to do with it? Like, where, you've just been told by a doctor that you have 5 years of good health, that you may never have a child, that you're going to be on dialysis and go through transplant, and you have seen everyone in your family suffer under the weight of this disease. What is it that you really want while you can still do it? And it was pretty instantaneous. The answer was, I wanted to live in a big city. I moved to Chicago. I moved here in the 90s when the place was just Garden of Eden if you were an independent songwriter, right? There was everybody beautiful was working here at some point or other. And so you could go into, and I did when I was in my 20s, stay up late and go from, venue to venue to venue to see these just incredible people at work in the beginning of their career. Writing songs for myself, being able to access that, feeling like I was permitted to do it was really important. But it was also important for me as a writer. I see it as this incredibly important part of the journey because I can get lost in the research and I can intellectualize, and I really love an argument and I really love making sure people understand the facts. Songwriting doesn't let you do that. You absolutely have to spend time in emotion. You have to spend time in metaphor, and you have to spend time in collaboration, which is been such a gift because I think writers often are misunderstood as people who are very solo artists. And we're not. We're deep in collaboration with editors and readers and interviewers and the people who have thoughts about what we're making. And it changes us and it changes the work. And working as a musician, kind of bringing raw material into a place where everybody got to add something that they loved into the work and made it elevated was great training for figuring out how to be a writer. And I'm still making music. I still have collaborators. I've got another album that I'm starting to try and work to record. That's always going to be something that I keep going because even though I can't really tour in the way that I would need to in order to have that be my job, the permission and the joy and the complexity of being allowed to create this completely complicated ethereal art form, just it's never going to not be the best thing in the world.
You're such a polymath. I'm always drawn to people like you who are good at so many different kinds of things. Like, you're just such a Renaissance person. And on the surface, I think that someone might assume that this book is, oh, it's just a lot. It holds so much. It might be too hard to understand. There's something that you do with this book, with the story that is, it is about you. This is your memoir. It is about your family. But you have this way of sort of pointing the camera back out into the ocean, out there, out into the natural world, but out into the rest of the world and the rest of us. It holds a lot that is connected to all of us, and that you manage to help us understand so clearly. So I wonder, for people listening out there, what's something, any one or two things that you would like listeners of this interview to know, either before they dive in, if they're a little intimidated, and they should not be, because this is the first part of this is you're hooked and you're in. And there's no closing the book. Or as they finish and turn the last page, like what if you could talk to people about this book that obviously so much went into it for so long and it's out there, what would you say?
I mean, I think the most important thing is that people. I'm getting this a lot on social media right now where people have said, oh, it's on my TBR pile, or I've ordered it, or somebody told me to buy it, but I'm intimidated because I'm already going through so much climate grief. And especially like today, I came to this interview from scrolling through messages from my friends in Los Angeles who are dealing with wildfires. It's never a time when we feel like, okay, I'm feeling very settled and calm about the crisis in the planet. I see people who are afraid to begin it because they worry that it's going to be something that leads them through more fear, more bad news, more overwhelm. And what I want to say is, I wrote this because I couldn't sleep, because I was spending time being afraid of hurricanes and wildfires and the impacts on people I love, and thinking about extinction. And I wrote it to remind myself that there's a reframing that's possible, where we're capable of building up a muscle that allows us to see the things we're afraid of, not to be in denial, not to avoid, but also to feel, I think, what is true, which is that we have each other, we still have time, and we have, in fact, the capacity to hold the things we're afraid of and the things that we find beautiful and wonderful and magical at the same time, to go back and forth between them so that we don't feel so overwhelmed when the fearful thing happens, and that we still feel the ability to connect with each other and with the world that we love and not grow dead to it or afraid of it. And I think actually that's the most important thing that we can go forward with in this really frightening moment, is that muscle that enables us to move from that, the micro of I'm at the tide pool that I love with my child, and here we are looking at this incredible sea urchin, to the macro of I got a text from my friend in LA this morning. That ability to move between those two things is. It's a spiritual practice. It's the same thing that we're asked to do in the great religions and the great philosophies, in terms of reminding ourselves of our relationship to death and to not fear it. And that's what I want people to walk away from at the end. I want that muscle to be stronger when you leave my book, any of my books, any of my work, because I want you to be able to do whatever work you're called to protect the people and places that you love, whatever that looks like.
Erin Caffell, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I'm so happy to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure, such an honor.
Erin Caffell is the author of The Mourner's Bestiary. It's published by Row House Publishing. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.